Blog Talk Radio.
You are about to witness history in the making. From the dawn of history, a better way of life has been man's dream. Make friends, grow bigger crops, get real smoking satisfaction, strengthen our national defense.
And it's all because of
LiveInTheStudio.tv.
Good evening. Welcome to Las Vegas and the Mob. Denny Griffin here, and for the next 90 minutes, we're going to be doing a special program tonight about one of the incidents that most lawmen, anyway, believe was instrumental in one of the key turning points in the law's battle against Tony Spilotro and his gang. And we refer to it commonly as Bertha's. And it's an episode that involved the burglary of an upscale home and furnishing and gift shop in July 4th of 1981. And we're going to be discussing the actual event, what led up to the event, and what happened after that event, and why it is considered one of the major turning points in the law versus the mob in Las Vegas. And I'm going to introduce the guest here in just a minute, but first we have a guest with us by phone, the former FBI agent, Don Sickles. Are you there, Don?
Hello, Denny.
Thanks for calling in. I appreciate it.
That's all right. It's my pleasure.
Okay, and Don Sickles is a retired FBI agent, and he's got was involved in a very important part of the Bertha story. And because of the phone hookup and the possibility of feedback over the mics, we're going to do and talk to Don first. And he will share with us what his involvement was in the Bertha's caper. Now, one of the things that was instrumental in the success of the law's operation that night was they had an informant working inside Tony's hole-in-the-wall gang and Frank's burglary crew, a fellow by the name of Sal Romano. And Don Sickles was instrumental in turning or flipping Sal Romano to become a government informant. Don, would you share with us who Sal Romano is, how you happened to meet him, and what the circumstances were?
Sure. Well, this was back in the, obviously, the early 80s, and the Chicago division of the FBI advised, I was in the Tucson resident agency out of the Phoenix division at the time, and we were advised that there was a fellow who was a pretty good lock man that worked for a burglary crew out of Chicago and Las Vegas who was in the Tucson area and had apparently kind of transferred there to just observe some things. And so we got some information on him, and we found out that he was traveling back and forth between Las Vegas and Tucson, and he would was working with a crew over there. At the time, we didn't know who it was. It later developed that Frank can tell you some of the background of those people there, but that they would burglarize homes in Las Vegas, and a lot of the things that they would pick up, like rugs and various things of value, and he would bring them to Tucson, and they would fence them there. Well, we came upon him as he was also working what they called a coin route, where he, because of being a pretty good locksmith, was able to break into like laundromats and things in various apartments. And as a result of that, working with the Tucson Police Department, they were able to set up a surveillance on him, and it was where they were able to videotape him doing that, and he was arrested and then given the opportunity, because of his background of having been convicted quite a few times of various felonies, to work with us or to go to jail in Tucson or in Arizona. And so Sal and I developed a relationship, and over the next months and a couple of years, we were able to work with the Las Vegas division and develop extensive background on what was going on over there as well.
Now, Sal, the night that Bertha's actually went down, July 4th, 1981, Sal Romano was involved that night, and he was part of the so-called hole-in-the-wall gang crew. And you had a special assignment. You actually came to Las Vegas for that event, didn't you?
Yes. Another agent, myself, Bill Christensen, we came to Las Vegas with Sal, and we had set up in an apartment, and basically that Sal was operating out from under. And my assignment and with Bill was basically to stick with Sal and basically be his handlers while he was there. And so that evening we were just very close to where Sal was and kind of took care of him that evening during the Bertha's robbery or burglary.
And so you spent some, I mean, you didn't just come up for that July 4th. You were here for a while.
Oh, yeah, we were there for quite a while. We had things set up in Las Vegas so that Sal could have people by and socialize with them. And so we just were able to stay close to him and surveilling because we were not known to Las Vegas people since we were out of Tucson, so that we were able to come and go and be in close proximity to Sal every time he would meet with people.
I assume that Sal had a cover story and so on and so forth to convince everybody that he was a legitimate crook?
Well, Sal had known the various participants in the burglary crew for quite a few years because they were Chicago people, and Sal was a Chicago person. And he'd spent time in prison back in Illinois as well as in other jails around. And so he was not an unfamiliar face to various people. And Frank can probably give you a little bit of that information.
And did Sal have a girlfriend?
Sal, he did have a few girlfriends.
Okay.
The ladies liked Sal. Sal was a rather engaging character, very outgoing, and was a fellow that was very easy to get to know.
And was one of his girlfriends actually an FBI agent posing as a girlfriend?
Well, posing as a girlfriend. Yes.
Right. Not the real thing, but posing as.
No, not the real thing. No, that wouldn't have worked too well.
And it's my understanding that because she wasn't, of course, always around, that the apartment Sal was put up in was wired and so forth, and that the story was the girlfriend actually lived there, but she was an airline hostess or stewardess, and that's why she was off and away.
Yes, basically it was not Sal's apartment, it was her apartment.
Okay.
And so, but he could come and go there and everything else. And yeah, the apartment was set up so that we were able to monitor what was going on in the apartment. And so it was in a very nice, area. Not the best, but it was a reasonably nice area and close to the Strip.
And the night that Bertha's actually came down on July 4th, you were there, and then Sal was taken away from the scene fairly quickly?
Right. We got Sal out right away, got him basically, we handled getting him taken under into custody and then got him out of town, as it were.
Did after that night, did you keep in touch with Sal at all, or was that the last you saw him?
No, we kept in pretty good touch. He went into a protection mode, and But we were able to meet with him on occasion in various places to debrief him and everything else from that point on. And, you know, it was we had developed you have a tendency to do. We did develop a bit of a relationship you know, where he could trust what we said, and basically we trusted but verified with sound.
Okay, I'm going to get the other fellows involved right now, so we're going to do a mic mute switch. Appreciate Don, if you want, if you're able to watch or listen in. If you have anything to add or anything you want to correct as we continue the discussion, if you could call back in or maybe text in a message, we'd appreciate it.
Okay, I'll do that.
And
okay.
thank you very much for calling in.
Okay, then. Thank you.
Bye-bye. In the studio with me, I'd like to introduce my four guests. First of all, we'll start with a former Metro Police Department commander of their intelligence division, Kent Clifford. Kent? Thanks for being here. Welcome to Las Vegas and the Mob.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
And former FBI agent who was in charge of the local case agent here for the Spilotro investigations, Dennis Arnoldy.
Dennis? Thank you, Danny. Glad to be here.
And we have another Metro officer, former Metro officer with us, retired Detective Louis D. Tiberius. Louis?
Good
welcome.
To see you again, Danny.
Thank you. Thanks for coming in. And last but not least, we have a guest that isn't out all that often in the public here, and he's representing basically the mob side of the story tonight, and that is Frank Collada. Frank, thanks for coming in. Welcome to Las Vegas and the Mob.
Thanks for having me.
And I was just thinking as I was introducing you that you're surrounded by lawmen, but this isn't the first time that you've been in the midst of a bunch of cops, right? So. Back at the time this was going on, I'll mention a little bit about what our law enforcement people were doing. In 1979, Sheriff John McCarthy was elected, or elected in 78 and took office in 79. One of his first priorities was to declare war on the organized crime element in Las Vegas. Kent Clifford was put in charge of the Metro Intelligence Division. And you actually come up with a strategy to go after these fellows.
Well, between myself and my lieutenant and Sergeant Smith, we came up with a strategy to go after these guys. I came from a narcotics background, as did Gene Smith, and so we weren't really familiar with the players in the organized crime.
Mm-hmm.
So we started finding out who they were. And, of course, then early on we made some changes in the Intelligence Bureau and brought up some fresh faces so that everybody wouldn't know who they were.
Sure.
In order to do that. And our plan was to make Tony Spilotro believe his own press and get him the big head, because we knew that they didn't like the limelight, and I understood that Chicago would not like him being in the limelight all the time. And the other assumption was that the guys in organized crime never played by any rules. And we had rules we had to play by, but we needed to use all of our tools that we had. That included traffic stops or anything we could arrest them for, any time we could arrest them. That's what we wanted to do.
Okay.
And by that, we hoped to mess up what they were doing, in other words, and make them off guard and get frustrated and say things and do things that they wouldn't normally do.
So the pressure was on.
Right.
And Louie, you were part of the intelligence division as an undercover detective.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be up there at the time. And when they put us together. I think I told you this before. They had so many people up there.
Mm-hmm.
And they took a bunch of people somewhat isolated and specifically going after Frank and the Hole in the Wall gang. The big thing was looking at Tony and trying to get close to Tony, there was no way it was going to happen. And between Kent and Gene and everybody else, everybody figured the best way was to go overt and just go see these people constantly, visit them, keep an eye on them. And we had the entire intelligence unit. Everybody really knew. And the beauty of it was is that everybody really worked together. And you'd just have another detective working on something else. He might spot one of the players. And once he drops that dime on us, everybody goes and everybody sits on this guy. And we would follow him back and forth. The other thing was also to try to interrupt their money flow. Because if you're around them all the time, it's hard to get out there and work.
Burglar.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So that's in 79 when Metro really gets heavily involved in putting the pressure on. And in 1980, Dennis Arnoldy was transferred in with the FBI from the FBI office in Little Rock. And he initially was co-case agent for the Spilotro investigations and eventually became the case agent in Vegas and primarily involved with Tony's street crimes.
Exactly. That was what I worked, was the Tony Spilotro and the hole-in-the-wall gangs and that type of thing. We had other agents. There was so much going on, and you can relate to this, I know, that agents had specialized areas that we had to work. There was just no way we could do everything any other way. So that was primarily what I worked. It had already been going on when I got there in 1980. Charlie Parsons, Emma Michaels, Joe Gursky, they were all agents who had already begun the FBI side of the investigation, which, of course, kicked into high gear for us on October 10th of 79 when Jerry Lisner was murdered.
Okay. And I know that the people always ask this question because a lot of people who aren't familiar with the street crimes, when they think of Las Vegas crime, they think of the Skim. That's usually covered in the documentaries on TV and so forth. And the Skim was investigated, but there was another agent that was the case agent for that portion.
For the start of Skim, that was Agent Lynn Farron.
Lynn Farron.
Exactly right.
So there were a lot of different law enforcement people in both agencies involved in keeping an eye on the bad guys and trying to catch them. And prior to 79, there had been some problems, internal problems with Metro. There was a scandal about one or two of the detectives who had been caught giving information to Tony or other mobsters. And for a while, Metro wasn't particularly trusted. And one of the things Kent and Sheriff McCarthy had to do when they took over was to get that trust back and a cooperation between agencies. And I think by the time you came in town, that was pretty much reestablished.
I think it was well established when I came into town with Kent and Gene Smith and Dave Gruber and Louis. We worked very, very closely together, I thought. And,
you know, it's a really good point because without Kent Clifford there, without McCarthy taking mm-hmm. office, when you're putting something together like this, and these guys at that level decide that we're going to actually do something in the community, it's going to come down to our level. It's going to come down to either my level or Dennis's level. We're the ones who are going to have to do it. Usually when you get into that position, you're not only fighting the bad guys, you have to fight the good guys. You have to fight the administration, you have to fight the budgets, you have to fight all the rules that Kent mentioned before. What's remarkable about this is that even before the controversy, even before anybody decided to go to actually do some crime fighting, we didn't get along with the FBI that good. We didn't get along with customs. We didn't get along with a lot of people. Within our division, intelligence, organized crime, didn't get along with its own department. They didn't like us. They didn't trust us. Tell me, Kent. They were jealous. They were, you know, and we, when these guys came in, and they put everybody together, we went really out of our way to bring up patrol, to get into back with narcotics and vice, and put everybody under one umbrella. But the unbelievable thing, and everybody left. I don't want to take up too much time, but all these guys left, you know, after that big incident. I stayed there, and I've never seen it again. It was only one time that it came up again when I went back into intelligence with a guy named Galen Hammack, who put another squad together and had to fight the administration, had to fight everybody. It really didn't work.
And Sheriff McCarthy was gone at that point.
He was gone.
Yeah.
And if he didn't make that office, I would say if the other sheriff came in at that time, this would have never happened. Frank would have been living in Acapulco someplace, living a good life and with a lot of money. And it's amazing how we all work together.
Now, Frank, I don't want to use the word assumed office, but you got in Vegas about the same time McCarthy in 1979, early 1979,
right.
And you would come in from Chicago.
Right.
And we don't have time to get into the whole background, but,
right.
but you and Tony have known each other since kids.
That's
shining
true.
Shoes right. on the streets of Chicago together. So you came in, you were going to be, Tony had asked you, in fact, invited you several times to come to Vegas, and you were going to be...
Tony's backup. Watch his back.
Provide muscle when necessary
right.
and help out as needed with various things. And you actually, when you got into town, formed what became known as the Hole in the Wall Gang.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was your organization
setup. That's the label we got.
Yeah. and just briefly, so people understand that, is one of the
got a lot of other labels.
Look, I'm sure they had a label.
That was one of them.
one of the things they did to gain access to various buildings they were going to burglarize and to bypass alarmed doors and windows and so forth, they would go through the wall. So you'd get a hole through the wall and enter that way. And they obviously, probably the media, maybe, I don't know, the police dubbed it eventually the Hole in the Wall Gang as the title. And when I was talking to Frank at one point a while back, he said, when they got this name, the Hole in the Wall Gang, he said, probably every burglar now in Las Vegas is going to go in, so we'll get nailed for
that's
every burglary that's ever taken yeah. place.
That's what happened. It's like we supposedly committed thousands and thousands of burglaries.
So there were copycat crimes
yeah.
back then. But Bertha's now, getting to Bertha's, that didn't just happen in 1981. You actually thought about doing Bertha's when you first got in town
in
79.
When I first arrived in Las Vegas, yeah.
Can you tell us what how you happened to even think about it?
This Joey DeFranza was living out there, and his brother was a connected guy. He was a boss guy in Chicago. And we hooked up, and we were looking around at Scores. He was showing me Scores, different places. And he pointed out Bertha's, and he said, they got to have a lot of money in there. It's family-owned and operated, and there should be a lot of cash. So we looked around, and he said, maybe we could go through the wall on the side. I said, you can't do no wall job here. There's too much traffic, you know, even if you put a truck against the wall. I said, we've got to go look and see where the vault's in there. And he told me where it was. So I went in there, and I looked around. And anyway, nothing happened about that. Joey and I had a falling out. I had to run him out of town because he was caught cheating in the Stardust, and I had to send him out of town because of that. And then somebody else, we had a lot of headaches. These cops were driving us nuts. They were arresting me every other day for something, you know, just to aggravate me enough, you know, where I needed money, always in the headlines, all the bullshit we didn't need.
Yeah.
So I said, you know what, we're all going to get even here if we make the score. So I told Ernie the dimwit and Leo will do anything. Of course, Ernie, you know, he filled in this guy, Sal Romano, whom I would have never filled in.
Yeah.
Because I didn't trust Sal. I met him a few times, and I didn't like him. I just had a gut feeling about this guy, and I didn't like the girl he was with because she had nervous eyes.
Was she the FBI agent?
Yeah, she
okay.
was. She had nervous eyes. She was, like, really nervous around me. And I don't have a problem with females. But I know I had a problem with this one. She couldn't look at me. So then I sort of worked something up where I was going to send them on a score while she was there listening. And she didn't know how to get out of there. She was, like, didn't want to be a part of it. Could get in trouble.
Yeah.
So I said, well, and then they took off and we didn't do the score.
But after you and Joey DeFranzo kind of cased Bertha's, he mentioned it to you, and you were there. You made a visit, I guess, to the store.
Oh, yeah, several times.
You decided at that point, because you and DeFranzo had a falling out, so you kind of put that on the shelf, at least temporarily. You didn't go ahead with plans right then.
I think it took about 8-9 months.
Okay. Now, the while this is going on, the police, of course, are now in their mode of full attack mode.
Full attack mode.
Did you know when Tony invited you and when you decided to come here, did you know that things were really heating up, that the cops were
I can tell you what Tony told me. He says, look, this town's like a fishbowl. It's a small town. He says, you know, there's not many of us over here. He says, now, we got a cop with us and everything. He says, we find out a lot. He said, but once you got heat on you out there, he says, they'll sleep with you. They'll be with you night and day. He says, so don't bring your guys around me. Keep them away. I want you to get a crew. And, of course, I had listened for a while, you know. And it worked out that way. I mean, these guys, they'd wake up and they'd be there. You know, I'd sit in the restroom, they'd be sitting at the table next to me. You know.
So you knew they were there, they knew you knew they were there.
But yet, we were still able to rob.
Yeah. Well, you know what I was going to say? When you think of a large police agency like Metro, they're bigger now, but they were the biggest one in Nevada.
Excuse me a minute. We knew that they had problems with a budget, with money, and we knew that our equipment was as good as theirs, our radio equipment. So we figured we had a little bit of advantage. But then they got funded some way. They were crying they needed more money to fight us. I mean, you know, they were strapped. They're fighting each other. Then when they got the money and they got the feds with them, shit, was on. You can't beat that. It's like fighting the whole war. The whole
army. They like Custer's last stand or something.
Essentially, where we get the money is from the feds.
Feds have got deep pockets, right?
Indeed.
Indeed. So, you know, I just want to digress here for a minute. I heard something today for the first time, and I've been into this mob stuff in Spilotro era for a few years now, studying it. And I heard something I never heard before. And, Frank, if you could share this with us, that Tony Spilotro was the victim of an attempted robbery, armed robbery. And I never heard this before. So can you tell us what happened?
I believe I told Arnoldy this. I'm not quite sure. We were sitting in my place lounge, Tony, I, and some broad, and a couple other guys, and Tony was going to take the girl home because she lived in an apartment complex. It was a little dangerous. So he took her home. So we're sitting there, and all of a sudden, about an hour later, 40 minutes later, he comes hopping in. What the hell is he hopping for, you know? So he sits down. He says, I think I'm shot. I said, what do you mean you're shot? He says, some guy tried to rob me with a rifle. I says, you're kidding, where? He's on dumping the broad off. He says, the guy comes out between the cars with a rifle, and he wants to stick us up. He's got the rifle, and he's shaking. He says, I'm scared this guy's going to shoot me. He says, I know it ain't a hit. I know it's a robbery, and that's worried me more. He says, so I'm going with my hands up and down, like, take it easy, kid, take it easy. He says, I grabbed the rifle, I twisted it, the gun went off, the shot hit me in the foot. I aimed it at the kid, and he got on his knees begging me, telling me he had a wife and kids and he needed money, and I run him out of here. I sure got to be kidding. So I had a doctor that was on juice, you know, juice money, you know.
Uh-huh.
And Tony went over there, and the guy fixed his foot up. It's a true story.
Wow. And that's the first time I heard that Tony was ever almost a victim. In fact, got wounded, got shot in the foot with the attempted
robbery.
And Jews, just in case anybody's not familiar, would be money, high-interest loan sharking, they might call it. And you had several, I guess, prominent people, doctors and lawyers.
They all needed money. They all gambled.
Yeah.
They had to hide from their wives.
Yeah. Okay, so the hole-in-the-wall gang is still in business, but under a lot of pressure from the law. And now the Hole in the Wall Gang, so people know, it was the nickname, but there wasn't it wasn't like you had guys that were the same guys on every job. It would depend on the size of the score and how many people were needed. And then several of these people lived in Vegas. A couple came in from Chicago if you needed extra hands. So the hole-in-the-wall gang wasn't the same crew every time, right?
A few guys were the same all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like you'd have Ernie,
Leo.
You'd have Leo, you'd have me.
Mm-hmm.
And then Larry would come in, then this kid Jimmy Petrazzo, Wayne Metecki, then we get Paulie from Arizona, or anybody that we could get out for different types of robberies and burglaries. Mm-hmm. Some guys could show their faces, some guys couldn't. So whenever I needed a guy to show, give a face, to pull a score, I'd bring in somebody from Chicago. They may have had heat on them, or known in Chicago, but they weren't known in Vegas.
And you even would come and go from different airports. So if somebody was checking security tapes, surveillance tapes that
well,
wouldn't
if it
see
was
the...
a big scarred, let them fly into Burbank, and I pick them up in Burbank, then bring them to Vegas, because I know these guys used to check the monitors in the mirror. It was a small airport.
And your crew, the hole-in-the-wall gang, I mean, today you can read the newspaper and you see, well, somebody burglarized a house or held up a gas station, got $28 or something. You guys weren't out for those kinds of scores.
No.
You researched and planned
your victims. We did a lot of research. It was like a job, really.
Yeah.
You know, we worked on everything. I mean, there was times we didn't get hardly anything.
Yeah.
But our tips usually would tell us if there was something there. We robbed junk dealers, dope dealers, mostly, you know, if we got the opportunity, because you get more money.
Let's talk about the crew that was assembled for the Bertha's job, the July 4th job. And excluding Sal Romano, there were six of you. Right? There was you.
Right.
You were the crew chief, the boss of the thing. And then you had Leo Guardino, who was... primarily a thief, not necessarily a tough guy, not necessarily a violent.
Just strictly a burglar.
Guy. Okay, burglar. And he was also your business partner. You and him pulled a couple of early scores and bought a restaurant.
That's correct. That's how we opened up the restaurant.
The Upper Crust.
Yeah, with money we stole out of houses.
So you put it to good use, right?
Okay. 3 days.
It's a good investment. Case.
Yeah.
There we go.
So you got, Leo was your first member or first guy you recruited for the hole-in-the-wall gang?
Well, Leo, the truth of the matter is Leo come looking for me.
Oh, he did?
He was working in Vegas. He was doing some kind of sheet metal work. And when he knew I was in town, he come and looked me up. And he told me, oh, this is easy pickings here. And I didn't know if I could do all of this with Tony yet. And I know what Tony wanted me in town for. And I told him, you know, if you want me to get a crew together, these guys are going to need to earn. So that's when I formed the gang, you know.
And Ernie DeVino was another local thief.
Yeah, I met him through Joey DiFranzo.
Okay. Then you had eventually another guy who moved to Las Vegas, an old friend of Louie's, by the name of Larry Newman.
Yeah, Lurch, yeah.
Also known as Lurch.
Yeah, me and Larry got along really good over them years.
And Lurch was beyond just being a thief. He kind of liked to kill people, didn't he?
Yeah, he enjoyed it.
And he had money. He had been left a trust fund, apparently, by his father. And he didn't have to steal, and from what you've told me and everybody who met Lurch said he was a very intelligent man. He was not
very
some semi-retarded individual. He could have done a lot of things.
He just got excited over it, you know.
Yeah. And you actually met him in prison, right?
Yeah, we were both in the penitentiary.
In the psych ward.
Stateville. Yeah, no, we worked in the psych ward.
Okay.
We're criminally insane. We're the two biggest nuts up there.
And you guys were known as the Goon Squad.
The Goon Squad, right. Yeah. We weren't very well liked amongst the other gangs.
And you had one of the guys you would bring in sometimes was Wayne Metecky, and he was a Chicago.
Very clean record, no record at all.
Okay.
Karate expert. You know.
Did he have a specialty like violence, or would he do more or less everything?
He would do anything you wanted him to do. He would burglarize, he'd arm rob.
If I remember correctly, Wayne was the only one who beat Burkus.
Yeah.
He was the only one who got off.
You're right.
I think, yeah, we convicted everybody, I think, but Wayne.
Because the charges were dropped against Joe at first.
Yeah. And then that attorney, there was an attorney came in from Chicago.
He beat the murder case, Wayne.
Yeah,
I don't think he beat Burkus.
He didn't beat Burkus. He got 5 years for Burkus.
Yeah,
he got everybody copped out.
They all copped out.
He beat a listener?
He beat the Bob Brown kill.
Bob Brown case back in Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah. They got Lurch on that, but they didn't get him.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
Only because of the juror.
The last...
Oh, that was the jewelry thing.
Yeah,
the jewelry. Well, he didn't shoot. Stabbed him, bayoneted
him. Beat him on the head with a
machete head.
Opened up his head up on a vase. And
it was all Larry's doing, though, wasn't
it? Yeah.
Yeah, wasn't...
It was supposed to be a robbery. Yeah. Just a robbery.
Yeah. The last member of the July 4th was a former colleague of Kent's and Louie's, former Metro detective named Joe Blasco.
Yeah.
And he had been fired because the FBI picked him up on wiretaps providing some information to people. And, in fact, that may have been a contributing factor to Sheriff McCarthy winning the election because it was such a scandal over this this Blasco detective. And he ended up then, he had been providing Tony information, and Tony kind of kept him around as a...
Kept him around. Well, Tony used to feed him, you know, like give him money all the time. And he's the one who filled him in on Bertha's. I didn't want the guy with us. You know, I looked at it like this. If he's a cop, once a cop, always a cop. That's the way I looked at it. I never would trust him. You know, that's the way you are. Now, if that'd be like me, a crook, all of a sudden turn into a policeman, come on. You know, it just ain't supposed to be like that.
Oh, don't burst my bubble now. I thought we had you done.
I'm a bad. So when he wanted this guy to come along, I got it already. And when he come along, I wasn't happy. So Tony said, we'll put him in a... And on the radios. He's a good radio man. You don't have to be a genius to listen to the police radios.
Yeah.
You know, so we put him in the truck.
So as Bertha's came about, you had a pretty good crew other than up until you didn't know about Romano. But you had a pretty good crew other than
Pasco. I knew about Romano about 2 or 3 weeks before, maybe 3 weeks before the robbery, when Ernie told me that he told him about it. Then I got really upset. And I told Tony, I don't want this guy in the score. I said, I want to pass. Tony said, don't worry about it. I swear, he said, the guy put the alarm in my house. I said, Tony, I don't trust the guy. And Tony says, nah, it'll be all right. I said, we'll pass on the score and do it a year from now. Because we wanted to use that day. Because it's a four-day holiday.
Mm-hmm.
You figure you get the jewelry back to Chicago, sell it, get back to Vegas, and our hands are clean, you know.
Yeah.
So Tony insisted on me taking him with us. He's but just have the big guy watch him.
Big guy Lurch.
And he got away from Lurch.
So if Romano did anything fishy in front of Lurch was supposed to take care of him.
Yeah. A lot of good that would have done. We had really a lot of headaches.
We had a lot of problems.
And then I said, when Tony said that, I said, this is crazy.
But Tony wanted money. To go through with it no matter what.
Everybody needed money, you know, so they were willing to turn their cheek on it. And actually, I must have done the same thing because I could have probably stopped it if I forced the issue. But
it's almost ironic because earlier we were just talking about the good guys having to deal with their own administrators and their own people and their own bosses. So did he.
Yeah.
I mean, it's only ironic. It breaks down the same exact
would,
way with the...
Funny thing, mine would kill you. Yours would just fire you. A little difference.
Yeah, we had a much better retirement.
That's a good one. It should be with Robert Allen.
So is Frank and his associates are getting ready to in the planning stages.
I gotta say this much, I really hated these guys when this was happening. But I never hated them enough.
Dennis, we didn't like him too well, did we?
Yeah, no, we didn't like him.
But I thought about, you know, this is a job.
I don't think we ever called him Frank in those days.
No, we didn't call him Frank, no. So he had a lot of nicknames.
Yeah, a lot of nicknames, which I didn't like any of them.
Who was, somebody come up with, was it Faraway Frank?
Faraway Frank.
Maybe because I got away from him.
Yeah,
they got this. Faraway.
Well, of course,
anybody would call me
that
after a day time.
Yeah. Frankie used to get away a lot. That's what the problem is.
Because I was sharper than the rest.
We were out there trying to hit these guys all the time. He used to get away a lot.
It was
very discouraging.
I had a good feeling all the time.
Yeah.
Good gut feeling.
So anyway, while you and your people are planning the Berthas and how you're going to take it down, what you're going to do, these guys, now, how far in advance did you get the word from that Sal Romano had...
Not a great deal of time in advance. I think you said 3 weeks. That might have been
about a month, month and a half. He's got an advance.
Because we worked on it pretty quickly.
Before they worked him into it.
Yeah.
You know?
And then did you call Metro? How did you guys end up coordinating?
Through Yablonsky, I believe, and probably the sheriff, and maybe it was you directly.
Me.
Probably
Kent.
Okay.
And that was a nice thing about. We didn't have quite the. We had no. Nothing near the political problems that Metro had. Not even close.
Yeah.
So when we found out about it, my supervisor, Charlie Parsons, just said, make a plan and find out what you need, you know. And we had Gursky up taking photographs from the airplanes. We were able to get the radios we needed. Remember, we had special radios that
night. That was one of the biggest problems, the biggest things. The FBI came in with radios.
Absolutely.
That were totally...
We couldn't get the calls on it.
Yeah,
otherwise, we would get the calls.
Yeah.
And that's how they beat us. See, they got
absolutely
money. They come in with these radios with 90 million channels.
And we were able to do that. And and it really didn't take that long because, honestly, in those days, we had a full-time surveillance squad, which was watching you guys all the time anyway. We're quite adept at following and planning. And actually,
how do we get away with these scars? This is what I don't understand. You guys were always around us, but we always managed to pull scars.
Okay, now most of that early on.
You understand where I'm coming from?
Sure, yeah, I feel great right now, Frank.
Well, that was had to go to sleep.
I just felt good a minute ago.
That was before the FBI got it. No, actually,
actually, I got to tell you, Tony referred to these guys as having diabolical minds.
We agree.
Diabolical minds. This guy.
Well, you know, we were on you the night that you all shot that dope dealer.
Leo.
Shot the guy.
Yeah.
We were on you, and all of a sudden, I guess you guys left the house or something, and our surveillance squad thought they had been made. So they split. They didn't hear any gunshot or anything. And it wasn't until a few years later, after I talked to you, that we were able to. And there were other surveillances. After I talked to you, I found out that we were there while you guys were burglarizing.
Can you believe that?
We were on a surveillance where we broke off because one of the other guys called and said, I got so-and-so. Looks like something's going to happen.
That's
and
right.
And we left.
Yeah.
We left, and just as soon as we got off you guys hit a dope dealer.
Yeah, we used to like
you
that.
Guys, you guys, it was something to do with the cops. You were making believe you were cops.
Oh, yeah, that was the guy. That was I think that was that. The kidnapping deal, actually holding somebody in the house that becomes a kidnapping.
Yep.
Yeah, that was the one.
We just left.
Didn't we use that on trial, too, to show that you were there?
Yes.
Can corroborate that you were there at that time.
Yes.
And those surveillances were tremendous because they really help out in the long run.
If
you're watching somebody.
We had to do so many surveillances. And we had to bounce around so quick that we had codes. Every time we would meet, somebody would be assigned to pick up the chicken because nobody ate. Nobody ever ate. So we would have all our spots would be called Chicken Bones 1, Chicken Bones 2. And when you got the call, you knew where to go.
Okay.
Meet me at Chicken Bones 4. We knew exactly who they were following, where to go, and we'd go right there. And when we got there, there was chicken. One thing working for Gene Smith, you never went hungry. You had chicken.
Crazy man.
But to answer your question, it really didn't. Wasn't a great. You know, it didn't take a long time for us to really get into it. And
so within a few weeks, you guys put this thing together.
Yeah.
And
the planning went really smooth. It was surprisingly smooth.
This was the greatest
joint venture
I've ever been involved in, and it worked absolutely correctly. You know, usually you go on these things, well, maybe it's 50-50 sometimes, but it worked beautifully.
Yeah.
It was just unbelievable.
Everything.
And I'll tell you why it worked so beautifully, because Kent and the sheriff and Yablonsky let us at our level do what we had to do.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah.
And that's what I think the biggest thing comes in. They can think of something. They can make a plan. They can do it. But it's us who have to go out there and do it.
Absolutely.
And if you don't have faith or trust in the guys that you're working with, it ain't going to happen. It's not going to come back on you.
That's
and these guys, we would come back with some wild stuff.
We love
it. They said, do it. Go with it.
They were having problems.
I was amazed. I used to shake when I went into Ken's office.
Because we knew when they had problems.
I used to walk in, he said, what'd you do now? What'd you do now? We're trying to do.
But
they let us do it, though.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Everything worked out.
So you guys that were actually going to be on the streets had input.
Oh, we ran
had the support.
I'm serious.
We more or less ran the whole thing.
They did. Yeah.
We had a lot of input because it's easy for somebody to say, okay, you guys are going to go out there, and we don't want anybody to have this leak out.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys are going to go out and make sure Frank doesn't get wind of anything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's easy to say.
Yeah.
So what we did was went out there and did everything normally.
Mm-hmm.
We still went and picked them up. We still went and we used to sit up at the Upper Crossville all the time. We stop by everybody's houses, make our sweeps, even though we knew we had everybody.
Yeah, even though they used to do, they even pulled me over one time. A cop that wasn't associated with mm-hmm. them. And Louie mentioned it. Everybody teamed up together, even if they weren't on a case.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they pulled me over, and these guys knew if they check your insurance, they know who you were insured with.
Yep.
And then they'd get a hold of the insurance company. And I know they've done this. They may not admit it. But get a hold of the insurance company and say, this guy's a crook. It's a privilege to have insurance. And a driver's like, they'd take my friggin' insurance away. Then I had to go to brokers, and it was costing me like triple for insurance. So they were making life very miserable. You know, but they had to do it. You know, that's just aggravating after a while, you know. I never forget that big cop, Roberts. I think that was his name. Big guy. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Red-haired guy?
Mm-hmm.
I knew right after that they revoked my insurance. I just,
oh, Big Red. Red Red Red.
That's what happened.
Well, there was a lot of things we could do.
I understand.
And we had to do it.
That's the game.
Make you uncomfortable.
Right. And it worked. It definitely worked.
Right. A lot of things we did, we're still not going to admit we did.
I can't believe it. I probably could name a few.
Yeah, all right, that was good.
Spy and Buy. You've got to see before you buy. SpyandBuy.com. The world's first free video classifieds.
Hey, look at God.
Spy and Buy.
If I do.
.com. You've got to see before you buy.
It's a dream.
So when you first got wind that Bertha's was coming down, at that point, did you know who the crew was going to be, or just that,
oh, yeah.
So you knew some of the players, and you weren't, you
we
didn't
knew
really
who was in his crew, and crew. We, you know.
And you guys didn't expect, I mean, obviously, it probably would have been a great thing to have Tony physically there going through the roof, but you didn't really expect Tony to be there.
See, again, going back to the thing, weeks before, or leading up to this, all our briefings included transcripts that Sal was getting and the FBI was. And again, normally on investigations that I've worked, a lot of them with the FBI, you're not getting this stuff.
No.
Even though we're working with them, the FBI is not going to give us the transcripts or the wiretaps or anything.
And that's another thing. We're talking about Bertha's here, and we're talking about Sal Romano in this apartment, of course, which we had cameras.
Right, yeah.
And we had they'd come in from other scores. You remember?
Mm-hmm.
And they'd divvy up the property.
That was Ernie and Leo.
Ernie and Leo. We've got some great pictures
looking
of them.
Looking right into the TV and the cameras in their face.
They're holding up like this is a stolen property. And we could almost see the serial numbers on these things.
Unbelievable.
So that's going on all this time, too. So we were very well aware.
I remember you guys would... On the briefings, you were giving us all that stuff.
Absolutely.
But then our squad, our people, were taking care of all the surveillance stuff.
Yeah.
And we had all the transcripts from the surveillance stuff, giving it back to the FBI. So the briefings were phenomenal.
You see, look at all the manpower we were getting out there. If we had either one done it on our own, we cut it in half. And the police, of course, they've got patrol, and like you guys were all working together. Mm. Well, I mean, we couldn't have ever matched that. And... So it worked out very, very nicely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, and this, by the way, was the first time I'd ever worked with the local police. I'd been in the FBI several years at that time.
I'd like to ask this question. Do you think these guys would have, if you hadn't coordinated together, do you think you would have been successful in that particular bust of us guys?
Well, I think we'd had some success, but not like this.
Because
to me, Bertha is a watershed incident. I mean, everything just started flowing after we took down.
Yeah.
And I don't know that, you know, we would have had the information, Sal. We probably could have done that, but...
Knocked us down for some burgers.
Yeah, you know, we'd have missed out an awful lot.
Yes,
an awful lot. We keep saying Bertha's here, but we went to trial in Noriko. We're talking
Rico.
How many 70? How many charges did we have on everybody? 70 or 80?
I don't know.
A lot of charges.
Look to see how many times we hit so many people. If we weren't able to do that, if you got hit just for Bertha's alone, you would have never flipped.
Oh no.
No, I don't think you would have either.
Tony wouldn't have been in shape. He would have been.
Not have been.
You know,
not
it's the culmination of everything
going.
That came to go.
Five bad beefs that I had against me that.
Yes.
You know, like the one property thing, that's bullshit, you know. and another thing that was bullshit. I had a lot of things that weren't right, and I was going,
calling our work.
You know what? I'm going to be a,
that was my
what do you call it, an habitual, habitual criminal. I said, what the hell is this? I'm an habitual criminal now. I didn't even know they had a law like that in Nevada. Habitual.
I came up with that idea, but even my partner said, holy shit, you can think, huh? That's the first thing you came up with all year.
Now, when you got wind of Bertha's, and did everybody see the potential? If it came off right, what a big thing it could be? Or was it just another routine burger?
I think maybe right after. Right after it was all done, everybody said, holy.
Yeah,
we did it.
Yes.
Everything works smooth.
But the potential certainly was there. We certainly knew if we could bring down something like this that it would be very, very good. But like Louis said, it was beyond our expectations what happened.
But leading up to it, the potential of somebody leaking it or somebody else getting burned or somebody, or Chicago saying, whack one of these guys. Everything would have been set off.
Frank, they planned to.
Oh, yeah.
And that certainly helped it. We knew what Bertha's would be good. We just didn't think it would be that great,
yeah.
I guess.
Usually Murphy's Law makes an appearance in these things, and, the best laid plans end up something doesn't work right.
It was a good time for us to win.
Yeah, it was.
It really was. We had small victories with these guys, and we knew we was frustrating them. But this was a good win for us, and we knew that was going to be when we heard about it and we started planning it. We knew it was going to be a good win because then we'd have substantial charges against them.
Yeah, but you guys wouldn't let off.
No, you
use Ron as constantly. Because Tony used to say, there's more to this than what we're seeing here.
Mm-hmm.
These guys got more freedom. He says they're doing things they're not supposed to be doing. He says, so I know it's not the feds. He says, because these guys, they got to walk the line. He says, so it's Metro that's really the ones that are causing all this anxiety to us right now.
I mean,
which
it was.
You know what I mean?
Gang. We used to go see everybody. I spent a lot of time with your father-in-law. I used to go see Nicky all the time.
Nicky was a...
Go talk to him. He was very upset when he found out I was Italian.
He's a tough
Greek.
Little man.
How could you work the Italians? Well, that's part of my nickname, that you were. He used to call me the Greek.
The Greek.
So while the law is coordinating and planning what they're going to do about Bertha's, you and your guys are still making your own plans, right?
I have to go back to Chicago and make money. I can't make no more money in Nevada.
No.
Because I have too many cases, and they're still going to watch me, even with all these cases. They're hoping now that I do more. So I went back to Chicago and started doing robberies in Chicago to make money.
Yeah.
Pay another lawyer. Make another band.
Get your car insurance back.
Get my car insurance back. Re-register. Fictitious name.
So, now, the plan for that night was originally thought you had the six guys and they had Romano on it late on, but you were going to have three counter-surveillance types. You, Larry Newman, and Joe Blasco were going to be on the streets.
Right.
Watching to see if anything looked out of place.
Had radio. We had a CB channel that we picked on a CB radio. Then we had regular police radios.
Mm-hmm.
So we had two radios apiece where we could listen to everything. And the guys on the roof had a radio. So we figured by using a CB radio and putting it on another channel, we'd throw any cops off that were, if they were listening to the radios, which would have been a great idea. Because the only reason why you figured it out, you seen Channel 7 on Larry's car and Channel 7 on mine,
mm-hmm.
and the CB radio. Then they knew that we had CB radios. But I don't think they knew it up until then, unless Sal Romano told you. I don't know.
Yeah, we knew they had CB.
Then you knew
it? Yeah.
So that's where we were getting across with our communication.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that before Bertha's, though.
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
All right, so then Sal relayed that back to you. So we figured we had that going for us. Because how are you going to... We either use Motorola's, but they could pick us up on Motorola's.
Oh.
Walkie-talkies.
So now, and you guys needed tools, or the guys were going to be on the roof, which would have been Guardino, Metecchi, and Divino.
Right.
Who were going to do the actual entry. You had to go through the roof, and what kind of tools did you have to get through that?
You need saws, you need acetylene tanks, torches, stuff like that, drills to take the boards, the paper that they put on tar paper, then you cut the board away, and then if you run it to steel on top of the safe, you got to cut a hole in there to get through.
No, they're big tanks and stuff, right?
Very big tanks, yeah.
Equipment.
We brought them out from Chicago. Couldn't get them in Nevada because then it would lead a trace to us.
Okay.
Because we left them behind, so we had Larry bring them out along with a car.
Station wagon.
Station wagon.
The infamous station wagon.
So that night, then, as you're planning this, is going to be you and your vehicle cruising the
right.
streets. Is going to be Newman and his vehicle cruising the streets. And you guys, I recall you leased or rented or something, a van, white van.
No, that was Sam Malosi's van.
Okay.
It was a cleaning van. They used to clean driveways and stuff, pressure washer.
With a Superman logo.
With a Superman logo.
Yeah. And he was stationed right across the street, right? The
commercial center parking lot.
And he was going to monitor the radios. He was the radio man.
Yeah. He was looking at the front of both.
Okay. And he was the ex-cop. So, and I imagine Tony might have thought that he'd recognize people, too, being an ex-cop.
Well, laying
know.
Down in the thing in there, he couldn't recognize anyone because it was a panel truck.
Yeah.
But he just wanted him in there on the radios because he figured if he could pick up any codes that anybody was using, he would know it before anybody else.
So this was, I mean, a well-planned thing on both sides. You guys put a lot of effort into it.
It was very well-planned, yeah.
Tony gave Joe Blasco more credit than they deserved.
Yeah, I believe that.
A lot more credit.
I really genuinely believe that.
Oh,
I was totally against Blasco, as I said, you know.
You really didn't like Blasco.
No, I didn't like him. He was a mooch. You know, as far as I was concerned, he was a more tough guy. He was a tough guy, you know, there's no doubt about that. But he was still a mooch.
So as the night's coming down, you mentioned it to Tony, your concerns. Tony said, nah, we're going with it, just keep an eye on it.
Well, I'll tell you, we're in front of Tony's house and he gave me a radio. Then I seen the car at the end of the street. I said, Tony, that's the G down there. That's what we refer to the FBI as the G, you know.
Yeah.
He said, no, they don't work on the weekends. Well, they did work on the weekends, right, Dennis?
Yeah.
I mean, unless you were on to something, right?
I was on plenty of those. Yeah.
I mean, you were on them, but only if there was something going on. And I don't mean to insult you, but that's where we were always under that impression. I said, well, don't you think they might be on us right now? And they're,
I don't work for the FBI. I tried to get weekends off.
Why would you work a weekend? I don't.
I mean, it's silly. You got family things.
I got a little league and
Disneyland.
But we work plenty. And you talked to Don Sickles earlier. Well, Sickles came up with Bill Christensen from Arizona. And we surveilled you guys with Sal on burglaries and that thing at night at a couple, several times.
Them, because I never went anywhere with Sal.
Yeah, but it was Sal and
Ernie
Lee. Yeah.
Yeah, we did one with Joe when Sal went up there and painted the alarms. Remember?
At the country club?
Yeah.
That was at the art dealer's house.
Yeah.
Remember
Yes,
that?
It was.
It sure
yeah.
was. And we used that later. We went back and we got the alarm with the fingernail polish on it.
Yeah.
And we
red,
used
so
that
like it's
to show that Sal was telling the truth.
Yeah.
He sure did.
Right.
And
yeah,
years of
cooperation. Yeah.
That was pretty sharp.
Yeah, it was sharp.
We did some things once in a while. It was pretty sharp.
You did well. You got me.
And my understanding was it was about 40 agents and officers involved. Does that sound about right that night that were actually assigned to?
That's
three... But two officer and an agent on each car?
Yeah, surveillance
yeah.
on our teams, yes.
And Hit was with me, Bobby Hitt.
Didn't you have eight guys with you?
Well, on the roof, it was just four of us.
Oh, okay.
And
then we had the arrest team down below.
And then we had down below. Lusby and all that.
Yeah.
But the four of us on the roof, two police. Bobby Hill was one of my other one was. And Jim Byers, the FBI, was with me. Yeah. We were on the roof.
They made me and Yablonski go away. They didn't want us in the area.
Yeah. No, that's actually... Weren't you on the roof of the Silver State, weren't you?
No, we were in a car.
But the video...
Me and Yablonski were together.
That's right. That's right.
That's why it worked.
That's why it worked.
The bosses had open cigars.
So just stay out of the area.
It was Charlie Parsons on the roof. Charlie Parsons was up there, and Joe Gursky and...
Mm-hmm.
and they almost got chased out by a security guard.
Yeah.
They had made arrangements to be up there, but they never got to the security guard. You know.
So you guys now set up where you're building, what, a half a block away or whatever, a five-story building. Bertha's was just one story, right?
Well, yeah. Silver State Building, it's still there, whatever it's called these days. But yeah.
And filming, set up and filming this whole...
Yeah,
thing.
It was video, early videotaped. The quality
was really bad.
Yeah, it was really bad. We could see shadows moving around and all that. And they had better visual because I would get my commands from them because I couldn't see the bad guys up there because of the way the roof is configured.
Those levels, different levels.
Different levels, yeah. And as noisy as could be because of the air conditioners.
Yeah. The 4th of July had to be, what, 120 probably?
It was hot. Those bulletproof
vests. That was a good day.
Man. Oh, it was hot.
Even leading up to that, a couple of days before, everything really had to be normal.
That's the best thing.
Everything had to keep playing and keep playing, and we were really nervous about things changing at the last minute. Because I think going into it, we really weren't sure if Joe was in the van.
We were never quite sure because I very much remember Gene getting on the radio and saying something about Joe being there or something, and everybody was cheering or something.
Yeah, I heard that, you know.
Yeah.
When I was in the car,
did you hear it?
It's him, he's in the van.
Yeah, I went up there. I told
very happy
that we
about
got
him.
Joe in the van.
That was
I wanted to put him in prison because he was a turncoat.
Yeah.
And what I said, you know what I said?
Absolutely.
The worst thing that could happen is when a cop does that.
Now, the day of that, all day, was the biggest problem was not being seen. Getting closer and closer to Bertha's, because they know all of us.
Well, we had surveillance around him the 24 hours beforehand.
Yeah.
And those surveillance guys, no air conditioning there. Jack Salisbury ended up going to the hospital because of the heat. And,
all right.
And these guys were standing right next to their van, so they couldn't move or anything. Larry and the other two, Leo and Ernie, they were sitting there talking next to the van.
I know where that location
they
was.
They had a meeting at a bar. Chinese restaurant, right off of Trap. Not far from Tony's
house. There's apartment complexes there. And that's where the meeting was.
Yeah, that's where we almost got nailed. We almost got nailed at that meeting.
I think Tony Montana's apartment.
Oh, okay. Over by Tony's house?
Across. It was right near there.
Yeah, it was near,
Topaz Apartments or something, or condos.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank, your deal, in order for this to work right, you guys or your roof crew, the actual burglars, had to go in right on the vault, right? I mean, that was the thing.
Yeah.
Drop right in on the vault.
Yeah, and it's hard. Because you're looking at a vault that's maybe 6x6, and you don't know how. When you get up on a roof, you sort of get a little twisted around up there. And Leo was off about, I don't know, maybe a foot. And he made a hole, and they said he made the wrong hole. And then he had to back up and make another hole. And then he landed on the on top of the vault. And then he would have went through because there wasn't steel.
You guys, the theory was that there might be up to $1 million in that vault.
Well, we were under the impression, we were told that there should be $1 million in cash because it was family owned and they were hiding money. We'll never know to this day if they had that money.
By the way, did the owners of Bertha's know about this or was this done?
No, not till afterwards.
So they were in the dark, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I wish they would have known.
And one of the reasons you guys decided to do it was everybody needed money. I mean, you guys had all kinds of charges pending, bail bonds outstanding, and legal fees, insurance, brokers.
Everybody wanted money. Everybody had to get out of jail for different bonds, different lawyers, and these lawyers that you think they're your buddies, it's all they want is money. They're piranhas.
Oh.
They want to get as much as they could out of you. You think they feel bad? $5,000, $10,000, $5,000, $10,000. Right there. Where's $1,000?
So you guys are doing surveillance starting 24 hours ahead of time, right?
Well, we had to every day, actually, beforehand. But we
ever since we had Sal, we were constantly.
Absolutely. But we set up. We actually set up people there like 24 hours ahead. They were there
around the clock.
And you knew this was going to come down, the actual burglary was going to be around dusk or right after dark in that area. So, I guess one of the theories was, and Frank was saying it was a four-day weekend, so they had plans to get rid of the stuff, back to Chicago, south, get it to the fence. was Tony's brother going to handle that, Michael?
Yeah, we were going to give it to Michael.
Okay.
Tony's brother, and Michael would have took care of it, and then we would have came back with nothing. But the money, we would have got the money later.
Later on.
You know, yeah.
And by the time...
The hardest thing is to hide the money, you know.
By the time...
We're going to take the money back there and drop it and bury it. Yeah.
So when Tuesday morning comes and the Bertha's owners come in and open the store and find out they've been had, you guys are already back. There's not the evidence is
sitting in our lawn chairs, laughing at everything. Yeah.
Who's the lawn chairs belong to?
Some neighbor or something. We saw them.
Okay. So now the night is. We'll go to the night of the actual July 4th. These guys show up, and it's when I was writing and researching this, I had a laugh. It was a real cat and mouse game. I mean, they got their counter surveillance units. You guys have got your surveillance units. At one time, Gene Smith, who Frank knew, I mean, he'd know him by sight.
It was like a nightmare.
He was in a car at a stoplight with an FBI guy, and he looks in there next to him and pulls up Frank. Frank, he said he hit the floor. I guess I almost cracked his head open to get out.
He said,
if Frank would have seen me, all bets were off. He sees me hanging around the area.
I think our whole crew, that was one of the biggest worries in our crew, was having one of them guys see us,
mm-hmm.
call each other and say, you know, Metro's in the area, let's call it off and stuff, and it would have been your fault. Mm-hmm. If Frank would have seen me and he would have called
I would have known right away.
That would have been
right
there.
Away. So they did a real good job staying away from me.
Yeah.
And I looked and looked, and I knew when I was getting pinched, when that van rolled up and back of me, I said, that shit, it's over. I knew immediately. There was no sound, no sirens, nothing, but I knew. Just as it pulled up, just where I said, it's over. And then I heard the radio. I said, oh, shit. It's over.
So these guys, they're burglary crews in the station wagon. That was Guardino, Davino, and Metecki show up, and they had a ladder, I understand. They put it up against the side of the building, and they took all their stuff up there, acetylene tanks.
Oh,
and
I'll tell you,
all that stuff.
Incredible the stuff they had up there.
They went to work.
Out of work.
You were in charge of the arrest crew for the roof, for the burglars
yes.
on the, actually going in, and you wanted to make sure, as hot as it was, that even though they had drilled cut the first hole, which was a foot or two off from the target, you wanted to wait till somebody actually went in the building to make it a burglary instead of an attempt.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
More serious charge. Okay. And as I recall from some of our conversations with the temperature and the bulletproof vest, you weren't particularly happy when they went through the wrong
spot. No, they told me they were looked like they had gone through, you know, and getting over the radio. And they said, hold off. They're getting out. I don't know what they told me, but they're moving over. They're going to, I know, I can't remember the conversation. And I'm thinking, boy, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go up and move these guys.
It was wonderful having them radios because everybody got a blow by blow.
Yeah.
What was really crazy, we were hiding, and the country club was celebrating 4th of July.
Yeah.
And they were playing, they had some fireworks, but they were playing God Bless America. And then over the radios, they're giving us a blow-by-blow of these guys banging into the building. And we're going like, only in America. You know? I'm picturing God bless America.
That's good. I didn't know that.
Yeah, we were laughing our ass off.
I'll tell you what, it was something else.
Yeah.
But once they said, okay, now you can, you know, go ahead or whatever. And you couldn't hear. They had these huge air conditioners out there, and we were hiding behind them, and you couldn't, you know, I don't know how many times they had to repeat it to me, because we just couldn't hear it, and it was just incredibly noisy. Then it would go off, then it would come on again, and then we got the word, and we moved forward and gone.
So when the second hole was in Guardino, I guess, was the one that went down through the hole into the vault.
Well, I think he went waist deep, didn't he?
Dropped, because there was a drop ceiling.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he had maybe 2 feet, 3 feet, and he dropped down.
So once he was in the building and
actually made it, you had the burglary.
And you guys, did you have any problem with these guys on the roof? Did they fight or resist? Or
not
anything?
At all. And not at all. The only problem was when I came over the roof, that shotgun, and Wayne was near the front of the building. I was telling him to do one thing, and our agents had come up from the bottom, especially Lusby, was telling him to do something else. He looked at me like, well, I've had it. I got a shotgun on him. Lusby's down there below.
Put your hands up. No, put them down. No, put them up.
I told him not to move. Lusby said, put your hands up. And put, and he looked at me like, hey, come on. And but, no, and I really didn't expect any trouble because they were ready for it. But, you know, these guys were experienced burglars. They're not going to get a gun beef, I don't think, on top of it. And also an excuse to...
Well, you made mention of that you don't want anybody carrying a gun, so...
That's not professional. Unless you're going on an armed robbery.
Yeah.
You know, then you carry a gun. And
well, we thought...
Nine times out of ten, you don't want to shoot nobody anyway.
Being an ex-cop, we thought Joe was definitely going to have a gun on him.
Now, you guys didn't really know until you actually went to the van that he for sure was him, right? You thought
it was
him.
We knew before that. I saw him in the...
Oh, you saw him.
Tony told him, don't take a gun with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I know Tony, you know, would have told him that.
Was there any special, from the police side, any special motivation or anything or any feeling because it was a former cop in there to make any difference? Or?
We got enjoyment out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we wanted him, because we knew what he was doing, and he was a turncoat, and so we was all looking forward to the day that we could put him in prison.
Mm-hmm. So there was a little glee.
There was that, and then a little sadness, because we all knew him as a cop.
Yeah.
So you had mixed emotions about it, but I was happy that we got him, because he was of who he was and where he was.
Right. And Louis, you were actually one of the people that arrested him, right?
Yeah, I took Joe down, yeah. That was my assignment.
Did you know him, or...?
Yeah, we had our... I came up to intelligence right after Joe. Joe went bad and everything, and I came up. And some of the guys I work with were old-time good friends of Joe's. So it really got to be a little bit tough. And when we started working... The hole-in-the-wall gang, I had a couple of run-ins with Joe, and he didn't like me. New kid, and he used to call me the rookie. And I think that's why Gene assigned me to...
I was just going to say, I can imagine it was bad enough to be arrested, but then to have somebody the rookie, come and get you.
I think Gary Magnuson from our office was with you.
Gary Magnuson was with me. He came out and... He walked right up to me. You really want to kill me. This whole thing is a setup to kill me.
Well, he
said
that.
Joe, you move and I'll kill you. I put the shotgun right to his head. Well, I thought for sure he was going to be armed.
Yeah.
He really did.
So actually, as it turned out, nobody resisted. I mean, there was no fights or anything like that. So now you're back in the picture, you and Yablonski. Pretty soon after that, you got to give a press conference and announce that there's been this major arrest.
Yeah.
And
I got pictures of them two dancing when I got the word.
Really? it's better than anybody, the way things worked out, better than anybody probably really thought was going to happen. So, it certainly appeared you had a real solid case here. I mean, a real powerful arrest and so on.
Well, the guys did a real good job out in the field, and they did a good job, and Joe Yablonski and I really liked each other.
Mm-hmm.
We were friends. I liked him, and he liked me.
So that made a big difference.
It made a big difference, and that helped in the work.
Now, it's the chain.
At the press conference, the six burglars that you had under arrest were identified and their ages and all that, but there was no mention of the seventh guy, Sal, so he was already gone, right? Don Sickles and his partner had... gotten him out of there, right? In fact, I'm trying to think, how long was it before the general public knew that Romano was involved in that?
I knew right away.
You did?
He knew.
Yeah.
I told Tony on the phone from the lockup.
He
my father-in-law, he saw Romano call the restaurant, and Nicky answered the phone, my father-in-law. I said, well, how'd you get away? He said, you're a rat bastard, that's what you are. He said, you got away, and then Sal got scared.
Because
Nicky, that's how you got away.
Yeah.
You're a rat bastard, he went again. And Sal hung up. But I didn't know that, Nicky. We went through this with him. But I had gotten a phone call out to Tony, and I says, you got to get that Sal. I said, he got away. He's the guy. I told you, Tony, he's the guy. He's not talking on the phone. I says, look, I'm telling you, take care of it. This is the guy. He didn't do nothing.
So Sal, later on, though, Tony had some plan, didn't he? when he came in for
like psycho thinking, you know.
Going to poison him or something?
Poison him, sure, to witness, you know, marshals or what. Really come up with them brain ideas. You know. But then Joe Blasco and I were in the same cell. We shared the same cell. Cried like a baby.
Blasco did?
You got to get me out of here first. I got to be the first one out of here. I got to get out. I said, I'll get you out. You know, don't worry, I'll get you out.
Well, Tony probably bailed all you guys out.
I bailed them out. I bailed them all out. Joe was the first one out. I never did get out. Yeah, I did get out a week later or something.
So wasn't it supposedly mob protocol that the chief, which had been Tony, takes care of his men if they're arrested and make sure they get lawyers and get out of
jail? Oh, yeah, if you're getting money.
So he didn't come up?
No.
Did that offend you guys? I mean,
it upsetted me.
Yeah. Well, you had to make good for the money.
They made mention of it. You know, my partners, they made mention of it.
Well, that's part of our thing, too.
We made mention of it, too, didn't we?
Huh? We made a lot of mention of it.
Yeah.
Funny, taking care of you.
No, it shit sticks in your mind.
And
you think, what's this guy doing? I'm making, making money. I'm giving him money now and then.
Yeah.
I wasn't giving him money off every score,
Yeah.
It'd be ridiculous if I made $5,000, I'm going to give him $1,000.
Yeah.
You know, it was like $20,000-$30,000 score. You get money, but he wasn't, pitching in on the bonds or anything.
These guys were still beating Tony to death with the RICO and everything else. So.
And there's a lot more things going on at this time, just like we've mentioned before. I mean, how many we ended up indicting?
A lot of trials,
17 or 18 people. You know, so we were still, all of us were all still going out there. Beating the bushes.
Yeah, it didn't just end right there. No. It just kept on going and going and visiting people, meeting people, talking to people, laying the groundwork.
Skimming was going on at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like a big deal. All that happened at one time.
It was really one time.
I mean, you couldn't have planned it any better than from their standpoint.
The timing was impeccable.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Everything
yeah.
happened at the same time.
So you eventually, after a week or so, got out from Bertha's arrest.
Yeah.
But then you had a charge that possession of stolen property.
I had a lot of different charges. At that one, I don't know what that one was even about. But I had to appear in front of another judge because this other judge, Goldman, he was a lunatic, this guy. You know.
Oh,
he was a cop.
We love lunatics.
He was a
best
cop judge.
The best judge we ever had.
And he had that gun there,
He had a gun in the
gun. He kept a gun in the thing.
He wasn't afraid to use it.
I knew this guy.
My idol. He was my idol.
Yeah, and I knew this guy.
I thought he was good.
He was very good.
I figured you would.
Yeah.
If you had crossed him in that courtroom, he may have just ended it all right then.
And you got convicted for that possession of stolen. Did Trevino set you up with his burglary to furnish your apartment?
I don't think I got convicted on anything. I had all these trials going.
You had a lot going.
A lot of trials.
Yeah.
I made three or four of them.
But he ended up going back in jail because you had so many cases. Somebody revoked
your
bond.
They revoked my bond.
Yeah.
They claimed that I threatened the girl with the stolen furniture, which truly I didn't. Nor did I send anybody to threaten her. That'd be stupid. But somebody evidently done it. I found out later that maybe Ernie was behind it, or my ex-brother-in-law. But I wouldn't do that. And that was gave them another reason to arrest me again, intimidating the witness.
Your ex-brother-in-law was involved, and Ernie was definitely involved.
So that's what screwed me up again. I wasn't even there. I didn't even know what was going on. So
it
was
not
another
gone.
Case. You know.
Yeah, we screwed up on that one. You know what I mean?
Gene Smith was mad because you were standing in the back and I was making another bond.
We'll take that one back. So.
Kept on getting out.
So when your bond is revoked and you ended up back in, that's when Charlie Parsons came to see you.
No.
Okay.
I just made bond and got out again.
Okay.
When I went in is when I got found guilty.
Found guilty.
For the stolen property.
So, and now they can bring this persistent felon stuff in, persistent criminal.
Upon sentencing, yes.
So you're looking at some stiffer time because, over just what the normal possession
of stolen
property.
That troubled me, what more troubled me was the idea of what Tony had done.
Yeah.
It troubled me that I was going to do natural life in jail, but there's always a possibility I could get out. Things could happen.
Yeah.
Laws could change, money gets bigger,
Yeah.
A lot of things, but I could see right then and there the money wasn't going to be around anymore with him.
Because
I told him, I said, you got to get $10,000 to John Mamet.
Who's an attorney?
Oh, Jesus, $10,000, yeah, Tony. And he only wound up getting $4,000 to Mamet, just for like an appeal or something, to get out and appeal by him. And then I could see that he was slacking up. you know. So when they came to me and said there was a hit out on me, and he said it matter-of-factly, he says, you can do what you want to do with it, and walked right out. Charlie Parson.
Great supervisor.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure that got you thinking.
Oh, absolutely. Made me call over the weekend. I think
yeah,
I had to wait till
Monday.
Yeah, it
was like a weekend, yeah. It wasn't too long.
I made a call within 5 minutes he was there. He must have been sitting by that phone all weekend.
So, and you wanted to meet without your attorney this time, right? You wanted him to come in and just talk?
Yeah, and then they told me that they would have to notify the attorney. I think that's the way it went down.
Yeah, and you had to give a waiver that you didn't want him.
Right, I had signed some papers or something that I wouldn't.
That you'd talk
to. And then Mom had to come in and talk to me. And at the time, I still wasn't sure I really was going to do this. And I wrote something on a little piece of paper. And I had it in my hand, and I was going to give it to Mom. And it was to tell him that, tell the little guy, don't worry, I'm going to play a game here with these guys. Because then I thought, I'll just play a game. I'll play both sides against the middle.
The little guy was Tony.
You know, you're going to think that. I'm still a crook, you know.
Yeah.
And I figured, I'm going to juggle this thing around. So I had that little note, and then I said, and I took it, and I just put it in my mouth and ate it.
Did you?
Yeah, because then I didn't give it to him, you know.
Yeah.
And then I had listened to Charlie more, and we wrote down more. And then after they told me, you know, how it was going to go, I knew that if I made any lies and I got caught in them, I was screwed.
Yeah.
So I had to just keep on going.
And that brings up what Dennis was saying earlier about the importance of all these surveillances. Because obviously any defense attorney is going to challenge your credibility and try to discredit you.
Sure, they'd always done that.
So they had to get all their I's dotted and T's crossed to be able to say no.
Well,
when Frank said this burglary took place, it did take
place.
We
took Mamet down to see him the first time.
Yeah.
And Bill Coote and I and Charlie met Mamet in the hallway. Down at the jail, and when we told him what we was going to do, Mamet turned white. I almost advised him of his rights. I thought he would confess to me.
That's funny.
And then we went in to see Frank, and that's when they did that.
He said, did they torture you? Did they torture you? They were torturing you. No, they didn't torture me.
So part of the deal was, first you had to tell the truth. If they caught you lying, all bets
were off.
Well,
they didn't read me my rights. I had to tell them stuff that he wanted to see if I was credible.
Okay.
And they asked me a lot of questions, and, you know, they didn't get around to any murders. But he asked me a lot of questions and still hadn't read my rights. So I was free to say anything I wanted to say. But once they read me my rights, then I was, you know, I had to be very careful.
Yeah.
Had to get immunity.
Yeah.
So that's what happened.
Which you subsequently got.
Yeah, I got plenty of that.
And part of this deal included a witness protection program for you and your family.
Which they told me you wouldn't want to do it. But there's nowhere else for you to go because we can't. We're not funded to do that, I think Charlie said.
Yeah, that's correct. But we did fund it
for a long time before you took care of my family. Mm-hmm. I mean, they give me extra, you know. I think the witness protection program would have got mad at them if they know that they were doing that, you know. But they gave you no money, man. $1,100 a month ain't no money. Not the FBI, the witness protection.
You were used to more than that than the score, right, or small score.
They carried that around in one, not even in my pocket. It was petty money.
Exactly right.
So you went in, and that had to be a tough decision, because all your life you had taken beatings from the cops and everything else and never talked.
Well, actually, I wanted to kill myself. It does go through your head, and if you're a normal person, you know, a tough guy, you know, you think, geez, I'm betraying, you know, all these friends of mine and my family and this and that. So I said, shit, I'm better off just killing myself in there. So I thought of ways to do it, but they strip you of everything, you know.
Yeah.
But there is a way you could do it. I'm going to give anybody ideas. And I sat there and thought about it, and I said, it ain't worth it. You know, just get it past your family. So I figured I'd get it past my brother and mother, and that's what I'd done. And once I'd done that, it was easier.
And how did your wife take it? You were married at the time?
She's solid.
Solid?
She's solid, yeah. I'll stay with you no matter what. She's a tough girl, tough lady.
And she ended up in witness protection.
She did, and one of her kids did.
Yeah.
The other one resisted, but wound up coming in later.
In fact, you took him, didn't you, Dennis?
We picked him up that day. Actually, you didn't go to the witness security program for sure.
No, I bounced around with the Metro.
Metro.
For a while, I lived in every hotel in Las Vegas.
Motorhomes,
Lake Mead. I went everywhere.
Went fishing? Didn't you go fishing?
Yeah, I went fishing. Everywhere.
We'd go in there and they always had pizza for us.
Guy in the world.
We got some good food.
We got pizza there during the day. It was nice.
I'm so sick of this crap we're eating over here. Okay, Frank.
I have to tell you, though, that after Frank resolved himself that he was doing this and he had confessed to all of his sins, he was like a born-again Christian. He was a complete new man.
Yeah, it did. It changed me. It, like, really cleansed me. It worked, you know. It worked. I seen the other side. Yeah, these guys are good guys. Yeah. They genuinely are good guys. And I always said it's like a ball game. You know, you're playing in a ball game. They just happen to have a bigger team.
Really good. Well, if you guys had uniforms, it would have been a lot easier.
But
that debriefing area was pretty good because we all had a new view of him, too. And some of the stuff he was telling us, it was like, why are you a criminal? You could have made...
Yeah.
Some of the stuff he came up, you could have made some money. You could have, you know...
Exactly right.
Gene Smith told me one time, he said that when they, after Frank turned and Metro had the security assignment for a while, he says, I told my guys regarding Frank Collada, he said, if I get a call that he's been found dead, there better be a lot of dead cops laying around him, too.
That's a crazy,
amazing
man.
Time. Yeah. Amazing time.
And you had to testify against a lot of different people and different commissions and all that over time. But one of the things when you and I were talking was you had to testify against Larry Newman about the murder he did in Chicago of a jeweler named Bob Brown.
Right.
And you were telling me that had to be very uncomfortable. Here's a guy you were in prison with, you know, was part of your crew, and now you got to go in and try to put him away
from
life.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, he sort of disgusted me.
Uh-huh.
Because I seen, you know, I really got to look at him closer when I was away from him. He's a ruthless man. And it wasn't hard to testify on him. Wayne, I felt a little bad about. Because I always felt as though I drew him into everything. But
and
Larry
Newman, in fact, after the trial that you testified against him, ended up drawing a life sentence.
Right.
And he just died January 2007 in prison.
Thank God. I'll drink to that.
Yeah, he threatened you, didn't he? He was going to come back if he ever got out.
He's the only guy I worried about who ever threatened me.
Let's just go down the list of the six people. Sal Romano, by the way, is still in witness protection. He testified at the family secrets trial in Chicago last year as a government witness. So we know where you are. You're now a legit small businessman and author, I may add. Newman died in 7. Ernie DeVino is still alive as far as we know, right?
That's what I heard. I heard he got re-locked up again for something else. I don't know what it was.
Wayne Metecky is still alive as far as everybody knows.
Living in Chicago. Working for a law firm.
Working for a law firm.
Yeah, Sandy Volpe.
Okay.
That's the attorney that came down.
Sandy Volpe.
Yeah,
Sandy
exactly.
Volpe. Yeah.
And there was the other guy.
Joey Iupa's personal lawyer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was the other fellow that wore the cowboy boots all the time.
And we had heard a report that Guardino had died, but you have information that he's still...
He's alive.
He's alive.
Yeah, Leo's alive.
And Blasco died, two, 3 years ago?
Right.
He'd served some time, and he was a bartender at one of the adult entertainment clubs and so on. So some of the hole-in-wall gang's still with us.
Yeah, three.
Three with us.
Four, three. Wayne.
You.
Me,
Leo and Ernie.
Leo and Ernie.
Now, how do you feel, Frank? Now, are you glad things worked out the way it did? I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah,
worked out for the best.
And you,
I just, you know, I lost my family, and you know, my mother, my brother, my sister.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that hurts. But other than that, I picked the right. I done the right thing.
And you told me, and by the way, a little shameless promotion here. I got involved with this whole thing when I wrote a book. I decided to write the history of the true history about the Tony Sinatra there in Vegas. That's where I met at least Dennis and Kent and Louie when I was doing the research, called The Battle for Las Vegas, The Law versus the Mob. Came out in July 2006. And after that, Frank and I met, and we co-authored his book, Colada, which is his biography, and all the stuff we're talking about tonight, actually, he explains it in the book of what went down and how it came down. But so you're satisfied with the way things came out. It was a real change, turning point in your life.
Right.
Turned it totally around. And now you're a successful small businessman. You don't have to look over your shoulder all the time worried that somebody's, the cops anyway, you're going to be tailing your planting microphones in your car or what have you. You've got the mob threat, though. How serious do you think that is, that somebody in the mob would,
I mean, I know what it takes to go whack somebody, and, you know, they would have to really do some preparations to get me.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have to know actually where I'm at. They'd have to lay on me for a while. And then that means they'd have to go to a strange area, which is very difficult to do. I wouldn't go in Chicago.
So they know where he is right now?
No, I think we have to. Say it, Frank. Thanks for coming. So I think one time when we talked, you indicated that one of the things we're more worried about, I remember the old Western movies, the...
Cowboy, yes.
Yeah, the gunfighter who was getting older and some young guy wanted to make a rep for himself would want to take out the veteran gunslinger.
Yeah.
And that some guy wanting to make his bones might say, hey, if I can knock off Frankie Plott, I'll... My resume enhancement.
Well, they better be ready. Because I ain't running.
And you actually ended up working on the movie Casino, which is the fictionalized account of the Sinatra era, a lot of it. Right?
That's correct.
And you're in the movie several times.
Yeah, I did some of the hits in the movie.
No. Frankie's greatest hits.
Frankie's greatest hits.
Well, gentlemen, I don't know where this hour and a half went to, but we're a couple of minutes over. I want to thank all of you for coming in.
Forever.
Huh? Thank all of you for coming in. And it's really, I don't know, I sense even you guys might have learned a couple of things tonight just by talking that you didn't really know.
Just being here with Dennis for how many years and haven't seen Kent?
Yes.
Sit next to this guy. I don't have to chase him at all.
He's right there. Okay, fellas, thanks a million. I appreciate it. And Don Sickles, I want to again thank him for calling in and sharing his information with us. And thank everybody very much for listening and watching, and have a good week. Good night.
Spy and buy. You've got to see before you buy. SpyandBuy.com. The world's first free video classifieds.
Have a cigar.
Spy and buy.
If I do.
.com. You've got to see before you buy.
It's a dream.
Dog days, hot dog days that is, somehow have a way of turning out to be fun days. The pop and sizzle of the juicy meat seems to say, come and get me, I'm done to a turn. Yep, hungry or not, it's hard to resist the tantalizing aroma and taste appeal of a sizzling hot dog. The nice part of it is, there's one waiting for you right now at the refreshment stand.